cliffcentral.com.
What a pleasure to have you here, Clive. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Gareth.
Good. First of all, let's start with what's immediately out there, because I think people must go along and see your exhibition. A pile of stones. The pile of stones you refer to is a pile of stones that's usually on top of a person who's been stoned to death. Or in this case, am I being too conjectural? Is there something else that's a pile of stones? Because you're talking about something, a very specific scene that plays out in countries like Syria and Afghanistan and Iraq all too often.
Yeah. So the title refers to the piles of stones which are piled up in streets. So what happens is men are accused by ISIS of being gay. They're taken to the top of buildings. They're thrown off these buildings. Crowds wait below, and there's a pile of stones for these men to pick up and then stone the bodies, whether these guys are dead or alive.
It's so so civilized.
Yeah, I mean, it's a spectacularly barbaric display of murder.
You know, we often talk about human rights in the Western world, and I see people going crazy about Donald Trump and talking about how Jacob Zuma is a horrible human being, or Theresa May, Angela Merkel isn't nice to refugees. But there are people who are losing their lives in the most vicious, violent, brutal way just because of who they are.
Well, they're losing their lives because they love, and that's the great tragedy. I mean, all they're doing is they're acting on an impulse which is common to all of us, and which is the kind of most basic cementing of our humanity, the affection, the love of another human being. And enacting that love leads to death.
Yeah. Again, we're happy to be hypocritical about our own society, but very few people are willing to go where you're going here, which is to take your particular talent and your particular skill and to focus a light on something that is it's a bit further afield.
Yeah.
Because you could have probably chosen 1,000 subjects in your own country. And maybe there's even some people who would criticize you for this, but it seems to me that far away in this corner of Africa, there's someone who cares about what's going on over there.
Yeah, I mean, I have been making work about love for over 2 decades, and most of it has looked at work incidents in this country, narratives in this country, starting back in the 18th century, stuff I found in the archives. But I don't think empathy should be bound by the edges of our nation, and particularly if you're a gay person, one's identity is formed not by what happens within one's nation, as is all too apparent in this country, but by global initiatives and by identification with our brothers and sisters all over the world. And so whilst this subject really, as it took as its starting point, the murder of these men in Syria and Iraq, it is an echo of an echo of an echo that happens all over the world. This is primal fear for any gay man. So its immediate subject is based in Syria and Iraq, but it's something which awakens fear.
You use different media when you make your sculptures and you do your paintings.
Yeah.
I was told that you decided to use some difficult material because you felt it had to be difficult to execute the process.
Yeah.
You had to feel like you were working hard.
Yeah, yeah.
You used wood.
I had to feel that I was working hard, but more importantly, I had to feel that I was working slowly. Because what I did was, you know, the only images, the only record that we have of these murders are the images which ISIS puts out. And these are they're very skillful at constructing these images. They are spectacularized murders. So they photograph these murders from the buildings and from the pavements below. They edit the images carefully, and then they disseminate them on their own websites. And then they're taken up by very often right-wing Christian websites around the world and endorsed. The point about them is you click on these things and there's a kind of instant pornography of violence, which totally violates what these men's lives were and makes mourning for them impossible. They cannot be named and they're unnameable by their families. Their bodies cannot even be claimed by their families.
So what happens to them? They just lie in the street?
No, they're actually buried by the people who kill them. They're shrouded and then they're buried by the people who kill them in unmarked graves. So what I wanted to do was to firstly to look at these men for a long time. I didn't want to perpetuate this kind of instant gratification of violence. Mm-hmm. And so wood seemed to me the best medium to do this in. So I literally remake these bodies. I look at these photographs of these men falling through the air. And, you know, there are a bunch of pixels against a blue sky, basically. And I've got to then be a kind of intuitive detective to see what is a hand and what is a piece of fabric flying through the air. And this takes me a long time. So it's a kind of caring for the body as opposed to the desecration of the body, which ISIS perpetuates.
There are many of these murders on a regular basis in these countries, and some of them aren't even necessarily based on any evidence. Mm-hmm. Someone says,
yeah,
person X, you know, there could be a family vendetta.
Exactly.
I could decide, well, I don't like Clive, so I make up something. I go and tell the nearest mullah.
Yes.
And the mullah says, well, you got to throw him off a building. That's the court.
Yeah, it's the tragedy is that it's a handy excuse. It feeds into people's prejudice. So you're quite right. I mean, there's no evidence that all of these people are gay, and some of them might be killed as the result of political or personal vendetta.
Of course, it doesn't make it any better or worse. It
doesn't make it any better. I mean, the point is that being gay is still the excuse used to justify the killing.
Do you, when you're busy working on this, do you think about all this stuff?
Yeah. Of course. I mean, I have to look at these images for months. I've been working on this work for over 2 years. And, you know, gazing at these images is a very difficult thing to do because I have to gaze at them. I have to look at them in detail. And that's very difficult. And sometimes I just put them away and work in other kinds of methods. But you mentioned that I work in painting and sculpture, and the sculpture is very representational. The painting is not so. The painting allows me to explore the subject in a different kind of way.
Sort of more allegorical?
In a more, exactly, a more allegorical kind of way. For example, one of the striking things when you look at these images is these bodies, the site of memorialization is the air. These men are falling through air. Mm. And when you look at these images, the thing that is so striking is this blue sky. Behind them, various kinds of shades of blue. And I had to think about, okay, how do we take this most intangible of mediums, this air around, which surrounds our bodies, and use it as a place of memorialization? So I had to develop a kind of grammar, I suppose, of memorializing the air. So the paintings help me explore the subject in that kind of way, which is a kind of elusive take on it rather than the straightforward approach which the sculpture allows.
I'm interested in what you think about while you're, I mean, you don't just think about the violence, the physical situation that these guys are in. Yeah. You must think about a lot of things. You must think about where these bizarre cults, this idea of needing to kill someone because they're not like you comes from. You must think about religion quite a lot. You mentioned how some of these right-wing Christian sites, the ones that disseminate them in the Western world. Mm. So you must also think about the parallels between fundamentalist Islam and fundamentalist Christianity.
Yeah.
You must think about what it is in society that makes people hate.
Yeah. What it is that drives us to other people, that drives us to hate people who are different from ourselves, that drives us to always collect around what we know and what is familiar to us rather than to think about a more inclusive way of being in the world, which is not based on judgment and not based on punishment.
And do you get any closer while you're busy with your work? Is your work a kind of catharsis, or do you get to the end of it and go, well, I've got these ideas in my head of why people are such shits? That was a good. This was this sculpture's turned out great, but now I know why humans are terrible.
Huh? If you're asking, do I end up being more optimistic at the end of the process? No, I'm afraid I don't. No. But I do think there's what culture allows us to do is to mourn, firstly. And I think mourning and grieving is an act of solidarity. And I think it's a very important process for all of us to be going, for all of us to engage in and to ritualize it. These photographs are a desecration of these people's lives, but I think culture can give us an opportunity to think differently about them, and that's what I'm hoping I contribute through the process of making these works.
Do you sometimes think what an accident of geography can do for someone's life?
Oh,
if you're born, as Ellen DeGeneres in America, you can become the biggest TV star there,
yeah.
And you can have a very happy, successful, meaningful,
yeah.
Important life.
Yeah.
And there's self-actualization in that, and there's yeah. You can have real relationships. But if you're born Ellen DeGeneres in Syria, it's tickets.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're born Clive Hunnenberg in Syria, it would have been tickets as well.
I would have thrown you off a building.
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to speak in the way that I do here. And there's no doubt that lives mean different things in different parts of the world. Some lives matter, some lives don't matter. Some deaths matter, some deaths don't matter. Even within if we compare the deaths of gay men recently, if we think about the Orlando killings in America, as appalling as those deaths are, and I mourn them as well, if we think about how they were acknowledged by the world, we had Anderson Cooper on CNN narrating every name of those people and crying as he did it. Those names are known. And that knowing those names allowed people to grieve because you could place them within their family structures, within their social structures, within structures of remembrance. People could say, yeah, I went to school with Johnny or whatever it was. And thus you build up this kind of fabric of affection, which really is, you know, one of the kind of testaments to our lives and how we've lived our lives. For these people in Syria and Iraq, that wasn't possible. They cannot be named, they cannot be mourned, they cannot be grieved. So I'm trying to make provisional markings of these deaths.
I know that these are particularly the area you decided to focus on, but I saw something the other day that I spoke about on the show. I watched a video of a father leading his daughter out into the field with a bunch of other men, where he was preparing her to be stoned to death.
Yeah.
And by the way, we're not attacking that part of the world in particular today because we feel like being mean. It's just part of this discussion, and it's something that really affected me very badly. I didn't want to do anything afterwards. I just wanted to kind of get away from everybody, and you know, I wasn't sure how to process the thoughts myself.
Yeah.
So I can imagine with you sitting there week after week, month after month, busy with your sculptures and your paintings, it must be painful sometimes. This girl was pleading, she was begging, she was saying, Father, please, just forgive me, you know, I'm sorry. Yeah. I don't know whether she'd committed adultery or whether he thought that she'd committed adultery, it didn't matter.
Yeah.
But here's a human life, and he was absolutely said, I'm not going to, you're not my daughter, I'm not forgiving you, stop talking to me.
Yeah.
And then they took her away and they stoned her.
Yeah.
And you can watch the graphic part of that if you have to, but I didn't feel like it particularly. Yeah. It was upsetting enough to see her pleading for her life from her own dad,
yes.
Who wanted nothing to do with her. And I think there's something about us that, you know, as far as we've come as humanity, and we have come a long way, there are things that we can now start to conceive of that we were incapable of conceiving in years gone by. Even just for men who've started to talk about their feelings and for people to start accepting that other people who are not like them have as much place under the sun as they do.
Yeah.
But then you see things like this and you think how dark and backward and prehistoric we are at our core, how instinctive and mammalian and primal.
Well, we have come far. And two examples. I saw yesterday on BBC that the British government apologized for the prosecution of gay men in the past. Now, one can say
Oscar Wilde, right?
Yeah, Oscar Wilde and Alan Turing. You know,
Alan Turing. My God, this guy did more for. You use a cell phone every day. It wouldn't have happened without the research that Alan Turing had done.
Exactly. And these retrospective acts of justice are, of course, not of any use to the people concerned, but symbolic, there is a symbolic value is good. We need symbolic value. And within our own country, our constitution was an extraordinary achievement. And whatever prejudice still exists in our country, and of course it does, the perpetrators of prejudice can be challenged and they can be taken to the law. And this is an extraordinary thing. It's a tool which we can use. So as much as there is this kind of barbarism in the world, and that barbarism is being taken up by other people, we just need to look at what's happening in Russia and other parts of Africa to see echoes of it. Mm-hmm. And I think there are impulses within Trump's America which are deeply troubling as to what it means for gay people. We have to celebrate the things that are good, and we have to announce them. We have to speak them.
I agree with you. I also think it's worth reflecting at this point, and I'd like to ask you, rather than just philosophize on my own, it's interesting how art swells around human achievement and accomplishment. You mentioned the Constitution earlier, and the Constitution now lives inside a nest of art, effectively, on Constitution Hill. It was an experiment in expression and achievement. Yeah. And artists come from far and wide, and they want to participate in that. Yeah. And the more art there is, the more culture there is in a civilization, the more advanced it tends to be. Where the artists are drawn to something, that's usually a sign of sophistication. Or am I wrong?
Well, sophistication is probably a word that I would steer a bit clear of, because it sort of gives hierarchies which sometimes make me a bit anxious. But I do think that what art does do is it allows us to think about subjects which words don't necessarily do. So in other words, we can look at things which might be tabooed as a word. So if we think about AIDS, for example, as a word. This is a scary idea for many people. It's a scary concept for many people. It is undertowed by many taboos. But if we think about AIDS or we meditate on it, on its meaning through imagery, we might be able to access it without invoking the same taboos, without people being immediately scared. And I think this is one of the capacities of art. We can think about and talk about things in a visual medium or in an oral medium, which doesn't carry the same kinds of penalties that words sometimes do.
You've spent a lot of your life not only doing exhibitions like this one and very different ones from this too, social issues, things that are you mentioned love earlier, which is a great place to start. But you've also designed museums and galleries. I mean, that's micro, macro scale stuff. You really are going from the atom to the universe here.
Well, they're very different responsibilities, Gareth. I mean, what I do in the studio is just basically it's me, you know, thinking about what I'm interested in, what I want to make work about. When you're working on exhibit design, you have very different responsibilities. First of all, there's a client, there's a budget, and there's an audience. And all of those things have to be considered, as well as the fact that in those circumstances, you're working in big teams. There are architects and engineers and historians and archivists and filmmakers and sound designers. So, yeah, it's not just me. So the responsibility is very different, and it uses my skills in a very different kind of way.
What, utilization of space, the ability to pick up in your head an idea of what you want, and then to make that come to fruition on a scale of human size stuff?
Well, in a way, my role is to be invisible, whereas my role in the gallery is to be visible. My role in the gallery is to speak what I want to speak about, and emphatically speak what I want to speak about, as in this instance, a pile of stones. Whereas as an exhibit designer, your responsibility is to allow the speech of other people, to facilitate the speech of other people. So I just have to find the best material way that can happen. It's not about asserting my ego. The kind of exhibit design which is about the assertion of the designer's ego is, in my view, a failed design.
Do we have a big enough, wide enough, deep enough, diverse enough community of art appreciation, not artists, because certainly we have lots of talented artists, and certainly no one will say that any of those people isn't original in their own way. Is there an art community, though, or is it still very much a cliquey, elitist thing? These are the people who fund, the patrons of the arts, and who collect and who make it possible for people like you to earn a living from expressing yourselves. And you provide a very useful service to society, that's without doubt. But there are some people who are willing to put their money where their mouth is in that respect.
Well, there are people who are willing to put their money where their mouth is and to collect. And that's a very important function within the art world. But it's not the only function. I mean, there's public responsibility as well. Eh? Mm-hmm. And our museums, and our state and municipal museums should be collecting work. And one of the tragedies of the past, few decades is the, loss or diminishing budgets which these museums have to work with. And I think that's a great tragedy, because there's extraordinary art being produced in this country. Art which is ethical, art which is impassioned, which is impassioned by the issues of our time. And, you know, we have a lot of issues which we need to deal with in this country.
It tells our story.
Tells our story, exactly. And art is an important kind of voice in telling the story. And telling the story, the stories, rather, of our nation is vital.
You know, I'm a history fan, so I spend a lot of time reading history books. I spend a lot of time watching documentaries about long-dead groups of people in far-flung corners of the earth. What is always true is that the singular device that is used to interpret more about the state of that society than any other device is the whatever art is left,
yeah.
Whether it's sculpture, paintings, yeah. Drawings, language in the form of, yeah. You know, its written form, which is, again, usually represented in art. Without that stuff, we have no idea of what these people were doing, what they thought, where they fitted in.
Yeah.
Art gives you a context.
Well, I think there are two kinds of representation. There are two traces which are left behind as processes of history. The one is a documentary, so it's film and photographic evidence of events that took place. And we mustn't think that documentary evidence is without its fictions. It does have,
sure,
its fictions as well.
Just like art is full of fiction.
Yeah. But then there is art, which is another trace of history. And that takes a different form, because it's the artist's interpretation of what has been there. There's no responsibility to veracity or fidelity. It's more about an impression and a feeling. And both of these things are very important records of history, both necessary for us to understand what historical processes were.
Yeah, we wouldn't take, you know, Shakespeare's Richard III and assume on any level that it was historically accurate.
No, exactly. We wouldn't.
We call it poetic license, so artistic license must apply also for the people in the visual arts.
Exactly, yeah. Well, we wouldn't take Hilary Mantel's books about Cromwell and think about them as being absolutely correct. But there's no doubt that she gives us an insight into that man which we lacked before.
And there's a degree of interpretation, but maybe her interpretation's a little closer to the truth because she spent so much time studying him.
Yeah.
Now, what about your story? Where are you actually from? How did you get into this? I'm always fascinated about the background that leads to the foreground here.
Okay, so I was born in Zambia. Mm-hmm. And I was in Zambia because my father worked on the copper mines in a town called Luansha. So from my earliest memories, I have a sense that there was a world underneath the world that we know, because I heard these rumblings. You know, if you live in a mining town, and Luansha was only a mining town, there was a mine and people who worked on the mine, and that was it. And everybody, of course, you know, your dads went underground, you know, at night very often. And so I sparked my imagination. I think it was a very important process for me, because it started me imagining that there was a world which was invisible to me and which was totally different to the world which I inhabited. And so I had to kind of think about this underground reality. And I was reminded of it every now and then, because you would hear a rumble or a blast or a sinkhole would appear in the town, making me aware that, yeah, this was real. So, of course, then moving to Johannesburg much later in my life, made a kind of symbolic sense because, you know, we're a mining town as well.
We're every now there are rumblings under the
there
street.
Rumblings under our streets. There are sinkholes which appear. And we're made, you know, we exist because of mines. We exist because of the gold mines.
But your move here was obviously when you were much older.
Yeah, I was much older. I mean, we first went to Natal, and I went to school and university in Natal, high school and university in Natal. And then I've been here about 30 years. So it's home now. This is home.
Did it take time for you to find, and obviously these are, you know, evolutionary concepts, but did it take time for you to find your own artistic expression? Some people have it locked up inside of them and never get to let it out. Especially in oppressive societies.
Yeah.
And I would imagine South Africa, you could certainly include under oppressive societies up to the 90s.
Well, I think that I didn't know the word artist when I started making drawings. I always drew. I always knew that I was one. I'm one of those people who always knew what he wanted to do with his life. You know, I knew I could be an artist, and that was it, basically. In terms of language or subject, what I want to speak about, we've already spoken about mines. There are two strains to my work. One is what is land.
Yeah.
And very often what I call underscapes, the stuff we can't see, but which is still land. And the other is how we occupy the land, how we inhabit the land. And
These are controversial things to talk about in South Africa.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, in terms of our occupation of the land, I'm talking about social space and usually gendered space and usually queer space.
But even just land itself is always a contentious thing.
Totally. Yeah.
Because we need to own, we need to rent, we need to work, we need to exist in that space.
Yes. And we own visually as much as we own through legislation.
What's queer space?
Queer space is space where you feel comfortable. So every space which is created is gendered, in one way or another. If we think about, you know, the whole controversy about bathrooms, which is raging in the world right now.
Oh, you mean, for example, if it's a men's bathroom and someone transgender wants to use the women's bathroom, then in certain places, they're not allowed to do that.
I mean that, but I also mean spaces where we feel comfortable or not comfortable. So they're going to be spaces where, as a gay man, I'm going to feel uncomfortable because it tends to be populated by a particularly aggressive kind of straight man.
Okay.
And likewise, I mean, I've heard straight people say the same about spaces where they feel uncomfortable. But the point is that space is never neutral. Space is always gendered, and space is always kind of inflected.
What's the gender of this room now? You want to hazard a guess?
It's friggin' male, dude.
Yeah. Aggressive straight male, for sure. Yeah.
Is that because of the people in it?
Yes.
What? Me and Ben and Clive? Who?
You agree with me. It's male.
No, it's male.
It's definitely male.
It's definitely male.
I mean, don't get precious about it.
Well, I'm curious. It's the space I have to occupy 3 hours a day. I'd like to know what it is.
I said male. I didn't say chauve. I didn't say sexist. Okay. So, you know, I'm going to qualify this.
How could we feminize the space a little?
Jeez, the black must go. Hey?
All right. Blacks must go. You have never heard such racism in my life.
I'm not even going to try and qualify that.
So then a queer space would be a place where you would feel, or any gay, because again, surely, you know, it depends from person to person. People have to decide subjectively whether they're in
absolutely
a safe, a happy space. Yeah. Okay.
I don't feel particularly comfortable in many so-called queer spaces.
Okay, you'd feel not the same kind of discomfort, but it's not exactly your comfort zone. At a rugby match, let's take that as being the one place, particularly, let's say, when the team who's well represented in the audience is losing and people are getting cross. But you'd also feel that maybe in a gay club, sometimes it wouldn't be your scene either.
It's more about where you feel safe and where you feel welcome.
Than
about our tastes, if
right.
You can put it like that.
Because, I mean, I feel everywhere outside of my house is not particularly – it's a toxic environment to me. So,
because you're too well known, Gareth.
When you grew up, did you wrestle with and struggle with a lot of these concepts because of your own sexuality?
Yes, of course. So I think anybody who is not part of the mainstream has to imagine what an alternative could be. So, in a curious kind of way, that's good for me as an artist because, you know, it makes you think about what's the alternative world?
Yeah.
What's the alternative world look like? And what's the alternative world as a political structure? And these are important things for anybody to engage in. It tends to be that if you are comfortable in your political world, you don't think about those things as readily, unless you're provoked by your school and your teachers, whatever.
Which we usually call privilege. Because am I right?
Yeah, that's the word.
Oh, there we go. Do you think it's a little bit easier now, though? I mean, if you look at a guy or a girl who's gay who's 20,
yeah.
Do you think the world is a slightly less hostile place than it was for you?
I think it depends where they are.
Not in Syria or Iraq.
Obviously not in Syria or Iraq. Well, I think obviously in some rural areas of this country, it would be still a very uncomfortable kind of place to be growing up. Or not necessarily rural. I think some urban areas as well. But I think about during the course of the exhibition, I've been speaking to school groups. Mm-hmm. And these are 16, 15, 16, 17-year-old kids. And not once, and there must have been many hundreds of people, several hundred people that I've spoken to, not once have I encountered any kind of prejudice or squeamishness about the discussion of sexuality. And I find that remarkable.
It's healthy.
It is fantastically healthy, yeah. But people have engaged with the subject. They've been wanting to talk about it. There hasn't been, I suppose, a filter to their sympathy, to their empathy because of the subject. And that's, yeah, this is huge advance. So I think there is a big generational shift, and popular culture has had a great deal to do with this, you know. I often say to people that Will and Grace did more for marriage equality in the United States than anything else.
Yeah, more than the politicians. And even the politicians are willing to give credit, Barack Obama did,
yeah.
To people in popular culture who've made strides that enabled the laws to catch up eventually.
No, absolutely. And if we think about, we were talking earlier on about what languages allow us to speak a subject.
Mm.
Popular culture, more than anything else, allows us to speak a subject. If you want change, go to popular culture.
So when you started out as an artist, were you worried that you would never have money? Because a lot of artists go into that world in order to pursue some higher purpose. They go into it because I met a guy yesterday who painted a portrait of me. I'd met him once before. He took a bus all the way from the Eastern Cape to bring it to me.
Wow.
He wouldn't accept payment.
Wow.
And he didn't want me to talk about him. He would be horrified if he was listening now. But this guy did it, and I said to him, what is it? Explain to me. He said he feels it's his purpose. It's his expression. It's important to him. He's not doing it for money. Hmm. He's not doing it for publicity. He's not doing it for kudos.
Yeah.
So when you go into art, I'm not saying everybody has to be altruistic.
Yeah.
Or that everyone has to be a marvelous, you know, absorbed with their own self-expression. But there are some practical considerations in this.
Indeed there are.
Yeah? What's it like when you're an artist and you start out in the world?
You know, I came from...
Who helps you fill your fridge?
I come from a single-parent working-class family. So when I said to my mother I wanted to be an artist, the despair was large.
She wanted to push you off a building.
She wanted me to
become a doctor, a lawyer, or a teacher, or something useful where you can earn a salary.
It's exactly that, yeah. Wow. I mean, you know, like many working-class people, it's like, got to go to university. So, of course, I did go to university, but then I did fine art. So this was a guarantee of nothing.
She wail and cry in the kitchen as you spent her money on subjects like art history.
Well, she was so delighted when I did actually get a job. So I did spend the first sort of 20 years of my career being a teacher and lecturer.
Okay. And where did you do that?
University of Natal, and then what was called Natal Technikon back in Durban.
Was that a fun thing to do?
I love teaching. Uh-huh. Absolutely love teaching. Yeah. And then it fits, in Johannesburg. But, I just want to be in the studio. I never, ever want to sit in another committee meeting in my life.
There's something very attractive about the life of an artist to me. Oh, man. Being able to go into your studio, your sanctuary, sit down, go, okay, today I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, particularly when you do a number of different media like you do.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's an extraordinary privilege being able to actually go into your studio every day. You don't have a boss. You don't have responsibilities other than to your own conscience and your own creativity. That is, I mean, that's the biggest privilege anybody could ever have.
That and then to also be a very famous artist who sells their work for millions. That's also.
Yeah, the millions would be good. Yeah.
But I mean, you've had very successful exhibitions. You've had some very, very important jobs in terms of the design element of things.
Yeah.
So you know, as far as artists go, you are a tremendous success both on paper and in reality.
Well, I'm able to earn a living from many different sources. So designing museums is a defined profession as opposed to art. So you do get paid for it.
Do you keep your studio very private?
Yes.
Your space, no one else is allowed in there? They must leave you alone when you are?
Jeez, I wish they would observe that, but that's how I would like it to be.
how does it work if you're in the middle of something? Are you one of those people who will spend hours and hours and hours doing something and then suddenly go, oh my God, I haven't eaten, or oh, I haven't slept in the last little while? No. Or do you let the rhythm of life... You create office hours for yourself, effectively.
No, I create office hours. I'm very kind of disciplined. I get up at 5:30. I work for a few hours. Then I have breakfast around 7:38. Then I work for another few hours. I'm ruled by my stomach. I have to eat regularly.
Probably healthy, though.
And
probably
a lot
much better
it.
Thing in the long run.
Yeah, I also have to have a big old martini at the end of the day.
Nothing wrong with that.
Don't you think that's also a reason that the people of Syria and Iraq are so angry the whole time is they can't have their martini at the end of the day? Well, it would really take the edge off.
It certainly helps me, I tell you.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
I feel much kinder about the world after one martini, and after two, I'm pretty smiley, I tell you.
Clive, what about the issues that you think are still worthy of wrestling with, and you'll never run out of material.
No.
But what's next on your agenda? Because this is quite it's in the same vein. You mentioned you talk about love and everything else, but this is a very particular and peculiar part of what's going on in the current environment, the current world, your context. So what else do you really have on the list of things you want to tackle?
Okay. So something that I became really interested in actually through this, I mean, it'd been kind of lurking in the background of my thinking, but I looked at these crowds who gather at the bottom of these buildings where these people have been thrown off. And most people look up absolutely directly. They want to look at the spectacle. And there's this symmetrical relationship, if I can call it that, between them and the spectacle. They're not scared of it. And then every now and then in the crowd, you see somebody who turns away, who doesn't want to look, or who's looking reluctantly. Their body language tells you they kind of put their body at 60 degrees to the event. And they might look over their shoulder and look at the person who's about to be thrown off. But you can see they don't want to be there. And it got me thinking about what I call coercive masculinities. We don't choose our masculinity. We're coerced into it. If we're lucky enough when we grow up in an incredibly liberal place, maybe we get to make choices. But usually we have to negotiate these things. Life's a muddle. You kind of
just explain it to me a little more. I'm not entirely sure
so when
what
you
mean.
When you from your earliest processes of being socialized, you're going to be told, guys do that, guys don't do that. You can have that toy, you can't have that toy. That color, good. That one there, hey, don't go near that. And this is a process which we negotiate all the way through our lives. And I'm interested in disguises, how it makes people disguise themselves. Mm-hmm. They mimic, basically. And sometimes this mimicry can take extreme form. So when I looked at these people who are picking up stones, I'm thinking sometimes the defense might be that you pick up the first stone. The most extreme form of disguise might be that, in fact, you enact the very things which you abhor and which you fear.
Oh, but we know this to be true.
Yeah, we know
that the people who are most angry about racism are very often racists themselves.
Yeah.
We know that the people who are very homophobic are very often disguising their own homosexual feelings.
Yeah.
The policeman lashes the whore for the crime for which he most wants her.
Yeah.
King Lear.
It's exactly that kind of thing. So I'm become interested in how we represent these disguises and these mimicries and what form they're going to take. And some of the works on the exhibition are about this, about disguise. And there's, I don't know if you've ever heard of a dazzle pattern. So a dazzle pattern is a really interesting thing. In the First World War, military strategists invented these patterns, which they painted tanks and warships in order, supposedly, to disguise the identity of the object, which was a...
Is it almost like camouflage?
It's a bit like camouflage, but it's a much more extreme form of camouflage, and usually geometric. Of course, it didn't work because, you know, the enemy would look at the object painted like a dazzle pattern and say magnet. Of course, that's something they want to confuse us about. Shoot that thing. But it's used in contemporary society as well. Contemporary car makers use dazzle patterns. So when a prominent German car maker is testing their new coupe, they paint it in a dazzle pattern so that the competition doesn't crib the design.
In other words, it blurs lines.
It blurs the identity.
Prevents us from seeing the actual shape and form.
Exactly that, yeah. So okay. I've become interested in these kind of dazzle patterns as a means of disguise for people, as a possibility. I mean, obviously I'm speaking in an allegorical kind of way, but that is, I think, where I'm going to go. What forms of mimicry, what forms of disguise, what forms of role play we enact in order to survive in situations of extreme, in situations of danger, frankly.
Do you have a lot of your own work in your house, or do you try to sell as much of it as possible? And are there certain things that you're precious about that you don't want to sell, that you don't want to give away?
No, I'm not precious about anything.
Really? You're not precious about your own work? So if you've done something and you go, wow, I'm saying this privately. You're not going to go around telling everyone, look at how great this is. But you love it. You're just so satisfied with how everything turned out, because a lot of it is just luck. Some of the time you're just on a roll, something comes out right, and even you go, that wasn't what I was expecting. You don't get attached?
I get attached during the process. I'm strongly attached during the process of making the thing. As soon as I finish the thing, I have no interest in it whatsoever. It can go into the world and do whatever it needs to in the world. But the process of making, that's a different thing, hey? I'm a dogged, stubborn guy. Until the thing is right, it stays there on the wall, and I look at it and I get it to the point where I feel it's right. You know? And then it can go. But there's and I've thought about this a lot. You know, when you're making something, there's a kind of, you have something that needs to be said. If I can put it like that, you don't necessarily have the words to say it, because we don't make art necessarily about things which we know. We very often, for me, it's important to make art about things which I'm stumbling towards and don't quite know, rather than know. Otherwise, it's a boring process.
Yeah.
So there has to be this kind of element of discovery within it. And chance does play a large role in facilitating that discovery. But once that's done, and once I've made the painting, I think it's complete. There's nothing more I'm going to find out. There's, well, you know, all of these relationships within the painting are right. It goes off the wall, and I turn it away.
And you know when it's done?
I absolutely know when it's done, yeah. I mean, sometimes I have to have two martinis and come back the next day.
You're developing your reputation. My buddy smiles every time you say that. I'm interested in the process too, because I listened to a podcast the other day of Malcolm Gladwell's about the differences between Cezanne and Picasso.
Right.
In terms of the way that they, Picasso would churn out three or four works in an afternoon if he felt like it, and probably more on a really good day.
Yeah.
And he would not tinker with them afterwards. He would be happy with, there it is.
Yeah.
And he'd put out thousands of these.
Yes.
Cezanne would keep a canvas, and he would change it, and he would paint over it, and he would do another one, and then he'd start again.
Yeah.
And he'd incorporate ideas from the old one, and he'd keep refining and keep improving and keep.
Yeah.
And he'd drive himself crazy, but it was the only way he could create.
Yeah. But I think the difference is Picasso had a very agile intelligence. He would go from one idea to we'd do 20 ideas within half an hour. And the point was exploring that agility, whereas Cezanne's intelligence was the kind that develops by dogged perseverance. So he would look at that old mountain, Mont Saint-Victoire, and he would paint that thing I don't know how many times. But, you know, with infinitesimal differences sometimes, one has to say.
There are still unfinished paintings of his all over the place where he would just leave a line because he wasn't ready to do the mountain yet.
Yeah.
That's got to be the most frustrating thing. Do you think you are exactly halfway between the two? Do you think you tend more to the left or to the right?
Yeah, I'm probably a bit of both, but I like I say, I'm kind of dogged, so, you know, we'll make sure the thing is done.
It's they used in the same podcast the example of two artists, music artists. Uh-huh. So they used Leonard Cohen,
right,
and Bob Dylan.
Uh-huh.
Bob Dylan would, I mean, I remember there was a line that Bob Dylan was asked during the Cold War about whether he was worried about tomorrow, and he said, "Yeah, I'm writing this song quickly so I can finish it before the nukes come." But so he would do a lot of songs, and he would be able to create very quickly, and he'd have a melody in his head, and he'd put it onto paper. And he once asked Leonard Cohen, "How long did it take you to write Hallelujah?"
Yeah.
And Leonard Cohen said, "Well," and he got a little bit nervous and anxious, and he said, 2 years. He was lying. In effect, it had taken him 5 or even 7 years to write it.
Wow.
And he was embarrassed to admit that to Dylan.
Yeah.
And Dylan said, 2 years? That's forever.
Yeah, yeah.
But he kept going back and doing a Cezanne on it.
And aren't we happy that he did? Because what a great
beautiful, right?
Hey. So, I mean, there are values. And, you know, one of the things I used to say to students is you have to find a way of speaking. You have to find a grammar which is particular to you, you know. And until you do that, you're going to be frustrated. And I think that's the challenge for each of us. We all come with, you know, different memories, different intellectual kinds of ways, different ways of apprehending the world. And we have to kind of take that and then find the appropriate method, the appropriate enactment of that. And I think that's the biggest challenge for any artist.
Have you had any correspondence from ISIS about your exhibition? Have they said that they're coming to have a look, check whether they've been portrayed nicely, make sure that they're happy? You use two colors, by the way, very prominently, orange and the pink.
Yes.
The pink, obviously, gay color.
Yeah.
Pink represents, you know, the rights of LGBT people, which are... And often it looks like, in the pictures that I saw, some of it almost looks like swirling blood some of the time, perhaps, that blood has been spilled.
No, it's probably a dazzle pattern that you might have seen.
Perhaps in one of them.
But, yeah, I mean, pink is orange. Pink's the appropriated color from the Nazis, you know, so the pink triangle, which is then appropriated by gay culture as an act of defiance.
Were the Nazis the first ones to make the pink the gay color?
Yeah, certainly in any kind of big political sense, yeah.
Jesus, we shouldn't take our cues from them.
No, shouldn't take our cues from them. But what's interesting is that we can, as anybody who's oppressed, can appropriate and re-signify what the
tool
color
of
is
the
about. So that is fantastic. The orange is the color which ISIS very often uses to signify criminality. So, you know, they're very smart in taking a color And they dress people in orange overalls before they kill them.
We also put our prisoners in orange, don't we?
It's exactly, and that's the memory which they're invoking.
These guys have an appreciation, even though they're barbarians, they have an appreciation for symbolism.
Absolutely. They're so good at it. They're so sophisticated at using social media.
That Goodman Galleries, there's been some interesting stuff there over the last couple of years. You haven't done any of the president's penis, I should hope.
That's not a subject which I have much interest in.
Lucky you. Some of the people in his life don't necessarily have the option. But there we go. All right, listen, I'm fascinated. I'm going to have to come and see the exhibition myself with my eyes. It's the only way to really experience it.
No, you have to. You have to see it with your eyes and your body.
Yeah.
Because you have to I particularly constructed the exhibition and hung the work so that when you look up or bend down, this is part of the meaning of the work.
Terrific. Congratulations to you on so many years of terrific work. And I hope that many more are ahead and
Thank
many
you.
More martinis at the end of the day to reward yourself for a job well done. So go along to a pile of stones at the Goodman Gallery from now until the 18th of February. So you've only got 18 days to get in and go and see it. And you can actually, if you're lucky, on the 2nd of February, I suppose people might have to book for this because you're going to do a little walk around with explaining some of the stuff to people.
Yeah, it's on first Thursday. So, in fact, if you're there at 6 o'clock, I'll be speaking.
Okay, very good. 6 o'clock on Thursday the 2nd. That's this Thursday. Thank you so much, Clive. Pleasure to see you. And thank you for being part of our show this morning. We'll come back with the un-news in just a moment. That's next. All right, there we are. That's Fat Joe with Remy and Cookin'. I should have played that for the twin chefs earlier. All right, Ben. What are you doing today, Ben?
Today, Gareth, I'm going into the fiber world. I decided I should get fiber at home. So
wow.
Last few days I've been dicking around trying to get that sorted. But I think everything's going to be A-okay.
Have they got fiber in your area? I don't have fiber in my area.
Yeah, I
obviously live in a shitty place.
No, we do. So, yeah, best to get it done. And Daniel and I have been doing lots of DIY of late to make our place look more homely.
I saw you painted shelves and
Yeah.
You were carrying things upstairs.
Looking very adult-like.
And I'm not talking about because I was hanging around his house. These are all on social media. Daniela.
She shares a lot, yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go down there today, probably consolidate that. I need to go return some electrical appliances, which is always frustrating. Yeah, that's pretty much my life today, Gareth.
How exciting. I'm so glad I asked.
Yeah, me too.
These are the things that people do on a daily basis, you know? And we all have to worry about fiber, internet connections, electrical appliances.
Yeah, and fiber and talking to routers. And look, I've also got this really great microphone, which I want to set up some things for and start pre-recording some podcasts for my Monday show.
Very nice.
Busy day. Busy
all right, day. Excellent.
And
Ben,
also, there's cricket on today, 1:30. Betting on.
Do you watch that? How much of it do you watch?
Well, it's always on in the background for whatever I'm doing, and I've got a few bets that run, and then my mood fluctuates.
Do you make yourself a cup of tea every now and then?
Not really. I drink more water now.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Eat anything while you're watching the cricket?
All the time. Always eating, always drinking.
All right. Post something on Instagram later.
I shall do. My day.
Show us if you dig a hole and there's fiber at the bottom of it or something.
Day in my life.
People are excited. All right, there we go. That's Ben, and that's Mabs, and that's me, and that's Lucas, and that's you. We will see you tomorrow. Bright and early at 6 o'clock. Thank you to our guests, to Clive, to the twin chefs, most especially to you. So the Queen is in a very tough position. She's invited Donald Trump to her place for a state visit, but her people are gathering to protest such a thing, even urging her to call it off. She believes it's the proper thing to invite the new American president over, but she also doesn't want the peasants throwing poo at the palace gates again. She had enough of that after Harry dressed up as Hitler to that Halloween party. In other news, celebrities are becoming more and more irate by the day in the back of Donald Trump's latest actions. Not so much about his actions, but more that they're struggling to have their views on said actions heard by the masses. They feel their voices are getting lost in the general public outrage and are now turning on each other in an attempt to sound more outraged than anyone else. And finally, South Africa are about to take on Sri Lanka in an ODI today, but the tourists have become even weaker with more injury withdrawals. Coming into the team are the debutants Dontsaya Idintwarianyana, Rolling in the Deep, Nawanza Dick Smeller, and Shining De Silva, none of which have any experience on the hard and fast of South African pitches. I kid you not, those are names, I tried very hard with. Rolling in the Deep. Don't say I didn't warn ya. All right, we'll see you tomorrow. CliffCentral.com.